Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning, the 30th of September, last day of September. 30 days, half September, April, June, and November. Right. So this is the last day of September. Mike's fact-checking me as we speak.
Right, yes. I'm doing the rhyme we all learned in elementary school.
That's right. Indeed. This is it. So good Friday morning to you. Very nice to have you with us. We certainly welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the panel to you that'll be with us for the next 90 minutes to talk about issues in the news and beyond. And we welcome Dr. Alan Chartok to the proceedings. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. You may call me Alan. No problem.
All right. I will. I was just giving you your, you know.
Do.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Now, the associate editor of the Times Union newspaper is here with us. Mike Spain joins us this morning. Good morning, Mike. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you here. And Barbara Smith, who joins us each and every Friday and whenever else we can get her. And that is, she is an author and an activist, and it's a wonderful thrill as always to have you.
Thank you so much, Joe. And hi, Mike.
You may call me Mike, Barbara.
Yeah.
We never get to see each other. So,
so good morning. Let's go to some topics. And of course, the tragedy that happened yesterday was the train crash in Hoboken, New Jersey, killing one, injuring over 100 people. Still a lot of questions in regards to this. A careening commuter train plowed through the barrier at the end of the tracks, crashed into a wall at a terminal in Hoboken during the morning rush hour, killed one person, injured more than 100, and unleashed chaos as part of the station's roof came tumbling down in a jumble of metal. Officials said they had not determined why the train, which was carrying an estimated 250 passengers, was traveling at a high speed and failed to halt on the track. The crash sent passengers flying out of their seats into a violent tumble. Then the lights cut out. Shouts and cries underscored the sense of panic. And officials said the terminal, housed in a Beaux Arts building dating to 1907, would remain closed until engineers could assess whether the significant damage had affected the building's structural integrity. As we mentioned, there was one woman who was killed. She was from Hoboken. She was killed in the crash. That was from the collapse of the ceiling and all. At least 114 people were injured, a flood of victims sent to hospitals and a triage area that was set up around the perimeter, and many of those patients still at the hospital this morning with very serious, if not critical, injuries. So that is the setup to the story, and I guess it gets to the question marks. Because we don't know what happened, we don't know how it happened, and quite frankly, even what happened, right?
Right. I understand that today the authorities are going to expect to talk to the engineer who was piloting this this train. It could have been an aberration. You know, he could have had a physical problem, a distraction. Something might have gone wrong physically with him, or it could have been a mechanical problem. As you recall, a couple of years ago, down in New York City, a Metro North train rounded a corner and crashed, essentially, and people died and many were injured. And he had a momentary lapse. The engineer in that incident had a momentary lapse, and that was regarded as the cause. He had sleep apnea or something like that.
Yes. But,
and it underscored. And then the Baltimore crash after that, where it rounded a corner much too fast and went off the rails. These are all bringing up a common theme, and that is, why have these trains not installed positive train controls? That was mandated by Congress, I think, 5-6 years ago. The industry has fought it. They say it's too expensive. It's a very elaborate electronic digital system that uses GPS to monitor where the trains are. It monitors the distance between the trains and the next stop. It monitors their speeds. And if anything is out of order, it begins to make alerts, and it could even potentially, like the way a lot of new cars now, if you approach too quickly a car in front of you, it begins to flash and beep and even slows down some cars. You know, that kind of technology on trains, and the industry is resisting it because it's very costly, but this is another one that proves it's necessary.
In past crashes of this type, the cause has been a lack of attention by the engineer or an incapacitating event such as a heart attack. But in the wake of a pair of explosions in New York and New Jersey this month, investigators will also consider sabotage or terrorism, although authorities say there was no events of either, with no indication that this is anything other than a tragic accident. But we are going to let the law enforcement professionals pursue the facts, said New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Alan, when I guess it's just a sign of the times that we live in that when something like this happens that you almost have to consider terrorism.
I think that's right. And then you have to consider what the responses are. In other words, if you're one of the terrorist groups, you could say, yeah, that we were responsible for that. And then you'd have to wonder whether that was really true also. Nevertheless, we know that there are some bad guys out there and that they'll do what they can. My instincts are that is not what the case is here. It almost always turns out to be human error. But maybe that's not so. What is interesting is this response by the industry, it's too expensive. Is one life too expensive? I don't think so. So this is really one of those times when you say, you know, American greed versus and how much would we all be willing to pay into the system to make sure it worked well? I know I would.
Well, one of the problems is that, you know, in cases like this one, these are public transit systems and they're publicly financed.
Right.
The rail freight industry is also mandated to do this. And that's a much larger piece of what's using the rails in America today. And they are fighting it. And they are not in a position where they can't afford it. They can certainly afford it.
Yeah, this is congressionally mandated.
It is. And they've gotten extensions. Amtrak, after the rail disaster in Baltimore a couple of years ago, said that by the end of 2016, the Northeast Corridor would, I believe it was 2016, would be, all the trains would have positive train controls. But it does take time. It does cost a lot of money. But I agree, Alan. I mean, how can you put a price on this? If the technology is there, it's already being used elsewhere very successfully, why can't the industry just comply?
I believe the figure that I read, Alan, was that out of all of the tracks where it was scheduled, only 20% actually have this technology.
It's unbelievable. It really is unbelievable. I must say, you know, I have a new Prius. I bought it in 2016, and I love it. And I love it more for one thing than anything else, and that is, you know, that business when you're trying to go into the right-hand lane and you can't really turn around.
Yes.
And you don't really know? Well, now there's a little yellow light. It goes on. It's terrific. And the yellow light says there's somebody in that lane. Don't do it. Well, I had to wait a long time into my old eightage here to see this, but it is phenomenal.
Barbara?
Yeah, Alan made the point that I was going to make a few minutes ago, which is not one life worth all the money in the world. I'm sure that this woman's children, who are orphaned today, would think so. I don't know how many children she had, but it said they describe her as a mother. So
yeah,
I just find it really reprehensible, and it does have to do with policy. I believe that I heard that Governor Cuomo has been more proactive around making sure that this technology gets put in place than New Jersey has been, but I don't know if that's true.
Well, it's particularly tragic because this woman wasn't even a passenger on the train. She was standing in the station.
Right.
And then the roof came down when the train hit it. It's just terribly sad. Yeah, it's New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut have all been in various times in the last few years, you know, had these tragedies. And that's where so much population is, and we're moving thousands and thousands of people, millions really, by rapid transit and local trains every day. We know how many people are using it, and there's so many lives that are affected by it every single day, so many lives at risk if they don't work. There's really no excuse why the government doesn't come up with the money and make it happen.
It might be similar to why our infrastructure is also sorely lacking.
Our roads, our bridges.
Yes, which can also lead to tragic outcomes, tragic accidents, and similar kinds of things, although in a different context.
That's a great point.
Yeah, people don't want to talk about infrastructure. It's boring. But, you know, if we started to pay attention.
And expensive.
And expensive. But you're going to have to pay it down the road. If, I mean, if
right.
you put off fixing a bridge today, you're going to have to fix it when it finally falls down and someone might be on it.
Yeah, and having been in the position of commuting when that New York Thruway Bridge collapsed, remember that back
yes,
in the
right.
80s?
Yeah, 80s, yeah.
I had just started teaching at Hobart William Smith.
Oh, dear.
And the thing is, I got to drive one time on the highway before that bridge collapsed. And then, you know, yeah. I mean, my having to take a detour is immaterial to what happened. But people died in that.
Oh, yeah. My mm-hmm. goodness.
All right. I think six people died in that. I think it was 86, maybe.
It was definitely in the late 80s.
Yeah. And the but it underscores something else, that if we did spend this money on infrastructure, it would just the economy would just boom. I mean, it would create all kinds of jobs and pour money into the economy. And that's really what the president Obama tried when he took office in 2009, you know, and he got the first round of that through. But then Congress said, nope, this is too expensive. And they kind of tamped it down.
There was a story. I don't know, Mike, if you've ever traced it down, but it still remains one of my great nightmares of all times, that somebody stopped the car and tried to divert the traffic on that bridge when it went down.
No, I think it was another one on I-95
oh,
in Connecticut.
Yeah.
No, I-95 in Connecticut, but that exactly thing happened where somebody actually stopped, got out, and tried to wave down a tractor trailer, and the guy reportedly pointed his finger at him, and it wasn't his index finger, and then drove off to his death into the river. But
It's not fun.
Yeah.
Well, hold your letters.
Right. Right. But, you know, sometimes you're just trying to help other people. And
doesn't work.
Right. Doesn't work. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about this, get a few letters, and then we'll take our news break at the bottom of the hour. Alan and Mike and Barbara, you're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield. Offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs. SteveLewisSubaru.com. Lori Ilvesacker, Coldwell Banker, Village Green Realty. Serving buyers and sellers in the greater Woodstock market. 845-901-6129. The University at Albany Theater Program. Helping to produce theater and theater professionals for the 21st century. albany.edu/theater. And Preservation League of New York State. Offering EPIP, a revolving loan program to acquire, stabilize, and restore historic buildings in New York. PreserveNYS.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've got a few letters on the train crash in Hoboken, and then we'll take a break and we'll get to other issues when we come back from the break. So, Alan, we'll go to you.
Okay. Stephen writes, if human life loss doesn't move the establishment, how about the cost of shutting off a way for those who make Wall Street work to get their jobs?
Well, I mean... You know, and it's, I understand the letter, but it's a, we are talking about Hoboken, New Jersey, where people are going into
Lower Manhattan,
the world's largest city to do their work. Mm-hmm. And if not there to have the safety and to have the infrastructure to allow so many people going through, then where are you going to have it?
Right. Matt Mann says, with self-operating cars, trucks, and ships in the news, shouldn't we add trains to this list? And then he says, or are the unions going to be roadblocks, more jobs lost? I doubt that. I mean, I think
that train has left the station, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the way I feel about that is like human judgment is not, you know.
Infallible.
Oh, no. I was going to say the opposite. Human judgment, because I just saw Sully a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
right,
thank God for humans.
That's
like
right.
Him on that plane. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
yes.
We're looking at the outliers. We're looking at the unusual circumstances. So I think we should think about the technology as being the fail-safe when human error is operative, as opposed to defining the system as always just rife with human error, and therefore let the robots or whatever drive.
Well, I think
us.
That's a good point. Like, what's wrong with both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say it's not either. It's not either or.
Right. Yeah, we can do. We can do both.
Tom says every time you give tax breaks, that's less money available to deal with infrastructure needs.
That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I think there's a political bent to that. Okay, and Seth says Alan is right. Deaths and injuries cost less than positive something control. That's correct. That is right. Thank you, Seth. And David says, David says, the installation of a 225 million positive train control system may be a positive response to the deaths and damages from crashes. And New York Amtrak trains the addition of an employee once called a fireman with his or her foot and brain on the brake would seem to be a simple and much less expensive option. Since the 1950s, firemen have been eliminated and so-called cost-saving measures. Well,
those are on the Amtrak trains, not on like public transportation, right? Because
the commuter trains?
Commuter trains never had two, did they? Or did they, Alan?
Have a second, like a co-pilot. I mean, you know, a fireman would be like a co-pilot. And that did come up after the one in the Bronx a couple of years ago that perhaps they, at least until they get positive train controls, should have a second person in the control booth should something happen to the first guy.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We folk singers know that Casey Jones told the fireman to shovel on more coal. So there you go. Let's see here. I got to read these fast. You see what I mean?
Yeah, just one more letter, and then we'll go to a break.
I think this is a rampant problem, says Vicky. Everyone wants something to be fixed, but nobody is willing to put their money where their mouth is.
I got
to
hold you there, Alan.
Okay,
we'll be right back
good.
After this short break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Friday morning, the 30th of September. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, and Barbara Smith, our guests this morning, and we, our panel this morning, I should say, and we welcome you, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. I want to get to some other issues. We have been talking about the train crash in Hoboken that happened yesterday morning, but there are other items in the news, and we want to get to those. And we talked yesterday about the 9/11 bill, and we talked about it being the first override to the president's veto and a first for the president. And now, after a day, there's been some voting remorse, and many who have voted are saying, well, maybe we can work something out. The president gave a fairly passionate plea, and it seems, at least among House Democrats and even some Republicans, seems to be working. Is that your read on it, Alan?
Well, there is what's right as opposed to what's political. I think I said that yesterday. And this is clearly what's right. Any of these guys knows if they put themselves into the president's place that there are unpopular things that you have to do in order to keep the ship of state afloat and to make it work. Look, the Saudis are often, let's put it this way. The Saudis can be terrible people. We know that. We know that when they cut people's heads off because they marry the wrong person with a simter, or because women aren't allowed to drive cars, or for all of those reasons, these are not good people to be friends with. On the other hand, they buy everything that this country can produce for the defense industry. And, you know, we all know what Eisenhower said about that. And so, you know, half the budget goes to that. So he does what he thinks he has to do as a president, as opposed to somebody who is, you know, just figuring out holding his hand up in the air and saying what's political.
Mike?
Well, it was interesting that it was virtually unanimous. I think one senator didn't cooperate with it. But when Congress has before them a bill that pits Saudi Arabia,
you know, a foreign state that certainly has been criticized but has been a strong ally and a trading partner to the U.S. against the families of the 9/11 victims. How can anybody on an emotional level, back Saudi Arabia? And if there's justice to be had, how can you stand in the way of it? But it's a whole lot more complicated, a whole lot more nuanced, and that's the problem. They've made their statement. They say the families come first, the U.S. citizens come first, and they should have their say. But now, as you say, Joe, there's remorse. There's like, well, what can we do here to kind of just minimize our losses? And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's a very complicated situation.
And remember, Mike, that a lot of these guys are shills for organized interests in this country. We know that. They take their money, they take their campaign contributions, the rest of it. And now they're hearing from some of these sponsors who are saying, hey, we're going to lose business as a result of this.
Right.
And maybe we should rethink our contributions to you every year.
Well, President Obama on Wednesday night, speaking to Jake Tapper in a town hall meeting, said that he was upset to see that the override had come, he said it was his understanding that a lot of the people who voted against it really weren't aware of what it was and really weren't aware of what the implications were. I sort of took that a little political rhetoric, but what I've seen in the last 24 hours is a lot of the people who did vote against it said, oh yeah, we didn't really know that was part of it. So I guess that it's really coming into it.
You have to pass the bill to read the bill.
That's right. Now,
and it's bad in Congress and it's worse in the state legislature. I can
right.
tell you that right now.
Well, absolutely. And it's interesting that's really become a component of this and this discussion. By the accounts in the paper and in the press this morning, it seems like they'll maybe give it another go.
Yep. Yeah, it's a little embarrassing, though, don't you think, Barbara, that Congress would so strongly pass something and then within a couple of days turn around and say, oops.
Well, isn't that kind of in character? Yes. For how our Congress functions.
Well,
they did something. They did do something, but they only kind of half did it, if what you're saying is
yeah,
the case.
But I sort of like, I mean, at least if we can take anything from it, at least afterwards they said, oops. I think they need to say oops more often, right? Like,
or look before you leave.
Well, that's right, but let's try this again.
But the brief on them is that they don't do very much.
Yes.
So they did something, and then it's a oops. So, you know, kind of Three Stooges.
I think it's symbolic in that they certainly support the families and the victims of 9/11. But now we're talking about a really complex international military industrial, Alan, is that the term?
That's what he said.
Right? Situation.
That's what he said. Look, we all know how it works. You can't be a congressperson without the funding to run for office. And these guys, they know what they're doing in terms of satisfying both their public clientele and the people who are on, you know, who are paying the bills for them. That's what it's all about. That's where they're doing it. I'm not going to say it that way. I knew a congressman once, and you can take this to the bank.
One day I said to
this congressman, I said, you know, how come, you know, you are inevitably taking the Jewish side in fights with the Arabs? And he looked at me perplexed, and he said, you know, and he said something terrible. He just said, look up the rug dealers in the phone book, and you'll see how many votes there are on the other side. So a lot of these guys operate by putting their fingers up in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing.
So could you explain? We're trying to understand. maybe if you were here, we'd understand it. Better, but we're wondering.
You mean I'm not there?
No. Was he saying? Was that person you're working for saying that there are not that many?
Yes, that's right.
Rug dealers, but however many there are, that's a sole extent of the Middle Eastern. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Arab. Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
That is just,
absolutely.
Yeah, love that. That's
absolutely
great.
Correct. Well, I said it was terrible.
It is terrible.
But in fact, it is the way people think. You know, my job here is never to say what might be popular, but also to sort of say what is. And that is the temperament that people, that's the way people vote. They vote based on the potential for votes.
Well, don't you think, Alan, that some phones rang at some senators' offices from defense contractors,
yes,
in their states who,
yes,
said, who had gotten the word very, you know, privately that maybe those contracts are going to disappear now? You,
yes,
know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Very good point, Mike. And that's exactly what I was trying in my inarticulate way to say, you know, earlier.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the Donald Trump Cuba story that is making news a lot there, and we'll try to unpack that a little bit. We'll get to some letters as well. The roundtable will continue after the short break.
Support for WAMC comes from the Samuel Dorsky Museum of Art, SUNY New Paltz, presenting the Art Uncorked Benefit and Auction at the Century Association in New York City, Wednesday, October 19th at 6 p.m., newpaltz.edu/museum. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988, lglc.org. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, a country store since 1923, offering aged cheddar cheeses, nostalgic candies, New York products, and gifts, waterwheelvillage.com. And Crown Maple Syrup, Hudson Valley, cafe open every weekend for lunch, drinks by the patio fire, fall foliage, maple tours, and special events. CrownMaple.com for details.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump came under intense scrutiny Thursday for allegations that he knowingly violated the U.S. embargo on Cuba in the 1990s, a report that could hurt him among Cuban Americans in the crucial state of Florida. The story, originally published in Newsweek, said that Trump's firm spent as much as $68,000 on a foray exploring business possibilities in Cuba in 1998, which would be a clear violation of the strict embargo in place at the time. Trump spokeswoman Kellyanne Conway suggested in a television interview Wednesday that Trump had indeed spent money exploring business ventures in Cuba. However, she later told the Washington Post that she did not say that he broke the law or violated the embargo. Trump himself denied the allegations during an interview in New Hampshire, where he campaigned on Thursday and sought to discredit the reporter who wrote the story. "I never did business in Cuba. There's this guy who has a very bad reputation as a reporter." Actually, he has an amazing reputation as a reporter, but that's another story. "You see what his record is. He wrote something about me in Cuba. No, I never did anything Cuba. I never did a deal in Cuba," he told New Hampshire One News. Alan?
Yeah. When all else fails,
Alan?
Well, the answer to this, I think, is you have to accumulate the evidence. Now, we know he's a liar. He lies all the time. And we know that the Washington Post reporter has a terrific reputation.
David Fahrenthold, yes.
Yeah, for ferreting out this kind of information. And I believe I saw him on the TV this morning explaining the story. I tend to think that when you have a reputation for being a liar, a rather large liar, then, you know, you have to take everything with a grain of salt. I suspect that there is probably something going on there.
Well, the interesting thing, too, was Kellyanne Conway, who had admitted and agreed to the story early on and then started to walk it back afterwards. But she was very clear in the first interview that indeed this had happened.
And she tried to use it to say, see, if we can complain about what Trump did in the 90s, now we can go back and bring up what Clinton did in the 90s. And
that
legitimizes my criticism.
That is Bill.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I know. But the word Clinton, I guess. Yeah, you know, to me, I thought the embargo of doing business with Cuba was absurd in the 1990s. It was still long after Castro, and that the U.S. should have reached out to Cuba, as President Obama rightfully did in the last couple years. And it was kind of absurd. The whole world had to recognize Cuba. We were pretending it wasn't there. And nonetheless, it was against the law to commit your business resources to try to open a business or to spend money essentially as a business in Cuba, which evidently did happen. Now, Trump didn't go. Nobody's saying that. But he put a team down there and they spent what looks like $68,000, according to some tax records that were available to the public. And that's undeniable. So even if it was maybe not a just law at the time, it was he did violate it, evidently, and even his own campaign has admitted it.
And even if he didn't physically go, that's not the issue.
No. I mean, doing business with someone doesn't mean you have to physically be in the country.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I mean, if he sent his team, you know, there's only one thing he's looking for, two things, money and praise, you know. So
he wanted to go back to the pre-Castro era where there were a lot of American businessmen who owned casinos in Havana and made a lot of money. And I guess he might have seen that coming, and it still may come.
Alan, let's go to some letters.
Okay, we'll do anything you say. Other than the occasional letter about Rich, and I have to give a little lecture here, folks, about half the country says they're going to vote for Donald Trump. And there are many who have grave doubts about Hillary Clinton. I am not one of them. I'm a big fan. Nevertheless, I believe it is so important to have a voice on this radio station who gives you stuff that you may not want to hear. And I think most, quote, liberals are bigger than this stuff about keep Rich off because he's not the right kind of conservative, or because the Jewish man is anti-Semitic because he said something that doesn't jive with what you think. I'm so sorry. I don't believe it. But I just wanted to have that moment, Joe. Did you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, I agree. I think, we look for all points of view and voices. And there's a couple things about those letters that I'm amused at about Rich, of, say, the new guy. Rich has been with us for a really long time. So
right.
So I find that interesting. He's been a part of our program and a part of WAMC for more than a decade, and offering his opinion. He is a very good guy. He has, I think, is very well read and passionate on the issues, and I can't imagine finding someone better to articulate different points of view.
So, yeah, and he's a fine person who was recently awarded by Tech Valley for his pro bono work, trying to get young businesses a head start. So he really is an articulate speaker on a side that isn't always spoken about on this panel.
So, that's right.
Now, my understanding is that we read the same books. I couldn't quite get that.
Well, the book that you recommended last week.
Yes,
he is reading on his own, which it wasn't your recommendation. He just went off to read it on his own, which I think is really interesting. But I think even you, Barbara, would agree that he is extremely well read and you know, I don't want to over defend him because he doesn't need it. He's a fine panelist, and we're thrilled to have him on the show. And I think if anything, it's just a sense of outrage of all of us who work with him that there is, because the letters are really mean, right, Alan? I mean, they're just nasty.
They're mean, and I don't like it. And I think we're better than that.
Yeah, and
now, with that, all of that said, Joe, one last thing, and that is, I don't agree with one word he says.
Just for the record, we completely disagree with him.
Well, on some things, although we find a lot of common ground.
There is a lot of common ground.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, he's, to me, he's like the ideal conservative to be on WAMC because, for one thing, he's not hurling insults and expletives at everybody who's
no, he's interested in learning the other side.
Is
the other
different
point of view.
From him, and much like Alan, I wouldn't say I disagree with everything he says, but I do listen when I'm not on, and I hear things like, "Oh no, did he say that?"
With that said, if you're just tuning in, Rich is still alive. We're not eulogizing him. Still with us, and he'll be back on Monday's show. So. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay. And there are people who are sending me articles about this guy from the CBC who has never gotten one wrong, an election wrong, says Trump is going to be the president.
CBC?
Canadian Broadcasting Company. That has a perfect history, I am told. I have no idea
Everybody
if that's true.
Everybody is wrong sometimes.
Cuomo always used to talk about, Papa Cuomo used to always talk about post hoc propta hoc. You know, in other words, stuff gets made up after the fact rather than before. Who knows? Yeah. John says, Kurt is a friend of mine from Kirk Eichenwald.
He's the reporter that wrote the story in Newsweek.
Yeah. He's a friend of mine from Swarthmore days, but when he gets his teeth into something, he doesn't let go. And there you go. That's nice. Jamie says, I guess Trump has been paid so much in Russian rubles he had no choice but to look to Cuba for investment possibilities. I shouldn't read those things, because should I? I mean, you know, let's stay with it here. Rich stays. And we've heard from Matt, who says, the panel benefits from the diversity and honesty of all contributors. Liberals can be just as mean and dogmatic as the next partisan. And Yvonne says, I say this as a proud Bernie supporter who disagrees with Rich just about 100% of the time. The round table is better with Rich in the mix. I like that. And, you know, people come out and say the right thing. And then Robert says, I panel, as a liberal, I appreciate Rich, but I cannot understand how a man of his intelligence can defend Trump as he does. Well, you got to listen. And then Robert says, illegal dealings with Cuba, more revelations about his phony foundation, the shaming of a beauty queen, and after the debate, is the good ship Trump completely breaking loose of its moorings to reality? No, the media is finally seeing more profit in digging into his life and long-serving sleaziness than chasing rumors about Clinton that usually go nowhere. And that's from Bob in Albany. We see that. Maureen says, Rich was right about the Saudi issue. Hi, panel. Rich was right to criticize the administration for not finding a way to forestall this vote with diplomacy, a little money to settle the 9/11 family claims, ? For Maureen. Bob says, I certainly don't agree with much of what he says, but I appreciate hearing his point of view and contributions to the round table. Good for you, Bob. And Michael says, thanks for staying open-minded. Dear Alan and team, thank you for having an open platform to discuss pertinent daily topics from all sides. Keep up the good work. And Kevin says, support for Rich. I thought liberals were known for their willingness to consider all points of view. I guess that's true only if the point of view coincides with theirs. Keep Rich. And Mary says, hi, panel. Though I often disagree with him, I really appreciate hearing Rich's point of view, and I'm especially appreciative of the example you all set of civil discourse, which is far too rare in our society. And David said, I disagree with Rich Honan about half the time and with Herb London almost all the time. But please keep both on WAMC. It is important to hear different points of view. John says, yes, he corrects me. He's quite right. In the Latin, post hoc ergo propter hoc, the fallacy of composition. After this, therefore, because of this, by the way, go Howard Dean. And that's from John.
Let's see here. I want to get my timings right. But we have a few moments before we're going to go over to news, and I just want to make a plea here. for a couple of things. First of all, we have exciting news regarding the lockbox. We're just about 2 weeks. On Monday, we'll be 2 weeks away from the start of the fund drive. And
frankly, I'm scared to death, Joe. I really am. We got to get this money.
Now, the lockbox, right now, we're at almost at $200,000 in the lockbox already, which is an incredible amount of money. But, well, you know, we need a lot more. So tell us about Jane Kane, Alan, and the deal there and what we need to do before Monday, October 17th.
I know this wonderful woman. We've been friends for years. I think she was my student, but who knows? And she gave us some money in the last drive, and now she's giving us $10,000 because she said, I hear it in your voice, Alan. I know you need it. So I'll give you $10,000 if you can make $400,000 by the first morning of the fund drive. She's a wonderful woman. I know her. She is not the kind of woman who is, you know, a gazillionaire. She just really believes in this radio station, and I love her for it. She wanted to be anonymous. And I said, Jane, the reason I want you to put your name on this, and I had to convince her, Joe, real fast, is that I said, people, when you say anonymous, most people will believe it, but there are some who say, well, you know, I know public television and radio stations make this kind of stuff up. By the way, folks, we never have and we never will. But when I asked her to do that, she said, okay, I'll do it. And that's why she put the $10,000 up, and that's why the lockbox is open right now. Are there any tickets left for the Capital Steps show?
Yeah, you know, this is great, too. We had, I think there were 500 pairs of tickets available for Capital Steps. They're doing a special performance for us. It's one of their first post-election performances, and it's happening on November 18th at 7:30. So they'll have a lot of new material that will have been written from Election Day to the 18th. And it's going to be at the Egg. Every event that they've done for us over the past couple of years has sold out, and this one is almost on its way. I believe we're almost at 300 pairs gone, so there's only about 200 pairs left. More than half are gone. So if you want them, we don't expect them to last much more into next week. So if you want them, now would be the time. And, of course, not only are you helping the lockbox and getting great tickets, but you're also helping us make the challenge of $10,000 from Jane Kane and to get to the $400,000 point of the fund drive before we even begin.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, and we need to do it. We have to do it. It's WAMC.org. You can also call 800-323-9262, and someone will take care of you there. But a lot going on, and hopefully we'll have big numbers to report on Monday. But we're going to go into a break here. But, you know, even you can take that time out now before we come back and talk about other issues and get some tickets, help the lockbox, and do all kinds of good stuff. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Good morning, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Mike Spain, and Barbara Smith. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your comments roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. And we have some other topics that I want to get to, and then we have a lot of letters to get to. So we want to make sure that we have time for all of that. Let's go to the the topics. Let's start with you, Mike, because this was an interesting story having to do a bit of a non-politics piece, but does have to do with transportation in our region. And we've been talking a lot about New York State, about Uber, but now we're going to talk a little bit about taxi cabs.
Well, it's been documented. The Times Union did a series about 2 years ago that, said what a lot of people already had acknowledged, and that is that cab service in the capital region is somewhat inconsistent, intermittent, and not very good. People complain that when visitors come into the city, either fly into the Albany International Airport or come up on Amtrak to the Albany Rensselaer Station, they grab a cab. Some cabbies have dirty cabs. That they also some people allow smoking in their cabs, which is irritating, of course, and I think against the law. And then there's situations where they'll force fares to go together. So they'll take two or three people who are not going to the same destination from the train station or the airport. And then if you luck out, you'll be the first one in line, or you might be the third, and you're riding around different parts of the city while you need to get over to a building on, you know, State Street, and they're going over to the western side of the city, et cetera, et cetera. So to combat that, and there's been complaints in Troy and Schenectady also. And that's one of the big arguments that Uber makes. Uber is trying to get legislation passed across the state that would allow it to operate and not make it subject to all these local laws and sort of one law to cover every municipality. And they had not succeeded at the end of the last legislative session. As they got closer to getting that pushed through, the taxi cab industry hired a lobbyist, and they successfully warded it off. But people think it's just a matter of time before that bill will get approved, and there'll be a path for Uber to move into upstate New York. They are allowed in New York City. They basically have become the engine of the old car services down there. But it doesn't. They're not legal in. They're not allowed outside of New York City and New York State. So. To combat that, a bill passed in the legislature, and the governor signed it, that establishes the Capital District Transportation Authority, which runs all the buses in the Capital Region, and is a pretty innovative place itself, because they are using apps, they're updating their technology, they have smart buses, they have Wi-Fi buses, and Carm Basile said the other day to a chamber group where I was at that... their ridership is up significantly in the last couple of years, and they're working with big businesses that give discounts to employees, like Hannaford supermarkets or other big employers, where their employees can get discounts, and you can use smart cards, you can use your phone to this is going to be the state of the art soon, because they've just signed a new contract. Well, and they're also boasting that they are working with municipalities throughout the capital region right now to broker a single ordinance that each municipality would pass that would set a standard, set rules for cabbies, require inspections, you know, give accountability, and introduce new technology so you could actually call a cab. Yeah, like you could on, you know, in a city that has Uber. If you've ever used Uber, if you're in another state and you just pop open the app and you can order it and it can tell it where it's going to go and you don't have to pay, it's all charged to your credit card. It works pretty well, and it has revolutionized that whole ride sharing is kind of been the big competitor to taxis. So Carm Basile is talking to our reporter Tim O'Brien in the story we have today about how they're going to basically the four county capital region, Albany, Schenectady, Rensselaer, and Saratoga, and they're going to work out a whole system that when Uber finally does come, it'll be a little more competitive in the capital region, they believe. And they do have a track record. CDTA has a proven track record of being a well-run and high-tech operation.
You know, it seems to me that sometimes the legislature is so imprisoned by, you know, a group like the taxicab industry. Look, if you invested a huge amount of money in one of those taxicab medallions down in New York, and all of a sudden you saw it worth a third or a half of what it once was, and I don't really know that figure, but I know they've taken a real hit. And you can't talk to a taxicab driver in New York City who doesn't tell you something about how bad, you know, the fact that their business is going down. But as you say, Mike, it's competition. Now, my wonderful Roselle, we have a little tiny place at home, and Roselle puts it on Airbnb, and you know it has been terrific. We meet new people and all the rest of this stuff. Well, the landlords hate Airbnb, the hotels hate Airbnb, and they give money. And we know what the real estate industry does in this area. I only told you about ours because I think disclosure is so important, so that you know where anybody is coming from. But Uber, Airbnb, all the rest of these things, which have taken tremendous popular, you know, people really like them. And then there's always somebody to say no because we're taking the money. It's not right.
Well, Airbnb is a good example of competition in the hospitality business, and Uber is a good example in the fare, taxi business, essentially. What's good about this story is it gives an opportunity to the, contemporary established cab systems to adjust and adapt before Uber comes into the market. Uber is a very heavy competitor, and a lot of people complain it's unfair because it's not regulated the same way cabs are. And that's a reasonable argument. There's issues about insurance, et cetera. But right now, it doesn't exist in the Capital Region or upstate New York. And in the Capital Region, at least there's going to be an alternative, which I think levels the playing field a little bit.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that when I was a member of the Albany Common Council, the issue of cabs, taxi, transportation came to us often, not necessarily because we had power over some of the issues that are going to be addressed by this joint effort. I think it's really very positive because one of the things that was talked about was coming from the airport, if you were going to another municipality or whatever, just all the kind of complications of this being a kind of unique geographic area. So I think this is quite positive.
Yeah. And they say that, when you step off a train or a plane, the cab becomes your first entree to the area, and how that experience goes can really define how the impression you get of the area. And mm-hmm. if it's a bad impression, it's difficult to make another new impression, so that's an important part.
All right, let's. We want to get to another topic here before we have to go this morning and before our time ends. Alan, you had some letters too. We want to get to some letters.
Indeed. Good morning, Roundtable and listeners, says Andy. The carrot topped populist is doubling down on attacking pageant contestant Alicia Machado with sex tape allegations. Ms. Machado has a right to do with her body she pleases and is not to be criticized. Why Trump feels he can criticize her because she reported his comments makes one wonder on his fitness for office. Anybody? All right.
I think referring to the tweet storm that happened this morning.
Started at 3:00 this morning.
Right. And Donald Trump was up during the night, apparently was restless, and then started to use the Twitter sphere to again complain about the situation you just described with the Miss Universe contestant.
Can I just pause right mm-hmm. there? Do you think when that happens and Kellyanne Conway finds out, does she roll her eyes and say, oh, God, not again? Or does she go, good for you, Donald? Which do you think?
The first, but the question is, does she? I thought there was a rumor around that they had stripped him of his cell phone, so he couldn't do that.
So he couldn't do it. Take it, lock
evidently
it in the,
not.
Put it in the safe, get it away from him.
No, at 5:14 he said, wow, Crooked Hillary was duped and used by my worst miss, you. Hillary floated her as an angel without checking her past, which is terrible. And they go on like that all morning long. And that I'll bet you that that was not vetted through the campaign, structure and probably.
Well,
was.
I don't think they can, Mike. I don't think they're allowed to do that.
And watching Morning Joe this morning, they were talking about how just beyond bizarre it is that someone running for president would be spending his time on this. But as someone also pointed out on that show, that when they were talking about when he would have his arguments with Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes.
Or I don't even know if they were arguments. I think there was like slugfest, him just insulting her horribly. I don't know what the response was. I assume there was a response from her because she is a person.
Yeah, but she deserved it, Barbara.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Joe. Glad to see you've lost your mind.
I just thought that was an interesting response during the debate. Yeah,
right,
but she deserved it.
Right, but the thing
it had
is
a lot to do with nuclear arms, which is what they were talking about when it came up. But go ahead.
They pointed out that he always did it a couple of weeks before The Apprentice was premiering.
So had it was part of the
season
hype.
Premiere.
A master showman.
Would have. It's just insane. I don't know, how this particular set to rife with sexism and fat shaming and body shaming. I don't know how that works in relationship to whatever the premier event is. Is the premier event the election? Is it the next debate? But it's just like, it's so absurd. But it doesn't seem to affect him in the polls, does it?
Exactly, Barbara. You are right on the money. That's exactly the point. No matter what anybody says, no matter what names you call him, you can call him Carrot Top. And by the way, I don't like that. No matter how you do that, he still is very competitive in this election. And I think anybody who loses sight of that, and I'm glad you brought it up, said that, Barbara, because it's so true. That's a good way to lose an election. Oliver says, it would be a mistake to stereotype all Saudis for the actions of the few or those in power or even the many. Further, keep in mind that half the Saudi population is female, who also fall into the category of all Saudis. Though women in that society may lack power, they still count as human beings and should not be marginalized. Wait a second. Who said all Saudis? Didn't I raise the issue of not allowing women to drive? Sometimes people make stuff up and they say somebody said something they didn't say. That's not right, is it? Not right.
I think not right. I'd go for that. Yeah.
We vote not right, Alan.
That ain't right. Right. Back to the trains. G. Cox says, no one knows yet what caused the train crash in Hoboken. So it's clearly premature to say that if positive train control was installed, it would have prevented it. I agree with that, except for one thing. It wouldn't have, like chicken soup, it wouldn't have hurt, right?
Well, I mean, even, right, you still would have known. If there's some, right, no matter what was causing the train to accelerate, if there was something to
prevent it,
and to even to alert those who were in control, then
you
do wonder. But anyway, it seems like it, at very least, it seems like it's a fair thing to discuss.
But I don't think that the cause of a dangerous acceleration. I don't think the cause is connected to the mechanism for stopping it, right? Or warning, is it?
I actually don't know. I mean, positive train controls weren't in place, and
right,
you know, until we know the cause of the accident,
sure,
you know, we can't really say. But they ought to be in place, and they would have been factors in the Bronx for the Metro North train, and they would have been factors in the Baltimore derailment.
And that was Baltimore to Philadelphia,
yeah,
right?
Right. Yes. And that was the main Amtrak line up the East Coast. So, and then when you look at the cost of all this disruption, the millions of dollars that will take to rebuild this train station and all the cost of rerouting everybody every day until that train station reopens, it kind of equals the cost of putting in these kinds of precautions.
Good thinking.
Molly says, hi, Alan. I just gave a contribution to the lockbox, although I'm a sustaining member of WAMC. In other words, takes something out every month. That's great.
That's great.
As a thank you for lengthening the panel discussion portion of the show, if you promise to make this format permanent, I will find more money next week. Please, please make it so. That's what Molly says.
One more and then we got to go.
Okay, Michael says, I can't always reply because I'm driving to work. Keep up the fact-based challenges toward the Trump campaign. It seems more people vote too often based on their feelings than with the facts. I applaud your attempts to inform us for a more well-rounded decision on November 8th, and that's from Hazmat Mike. Go ahead, Joe.
Alan and Mike and Barbara, thank you all for being with us. Have a glorious weekend, and we'll meet back here on Monday morning. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.